listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast, and I am here with my friend James Eglinton. James is the Meldrum Senior Lecturer in Reformed Theology at New College at the University of Edinburgh. And by the way, Americans, it is actually, I'll let James, who's properly Scottish, tell you how to pronounce Edinburgh. But I spend a lot of time telling Americans that it's not Edinburgh.
Indeed.
English people say Edinburgh, and you can hear James said in a second. James?
Yeah, so most Scottish people say Edinburgh, but if you're really, truly a local, you say something more like Embra.
Oh, interesting.
I think you would spell it E-M-B-R-A, Embra. But yeah, Edinburgh. Nobody in the UK says Edinburgh anyway, apart from American tourists a lot of the time.
Yes, so let it be known, any Americans listening, do not say Edinburgh. It's not a thing.
Indeed.
James, when he's not pronouncing the name of the city he lives in correctly, is also an author. He's the author of Bavinck, A Critical Biography, which won the 2020 Gospel Coalition Book of the Year Award for History and Biography. He's also edited and translated a number of other works by various Bavincks. And for those of you who are not familiar with any Bavincks, I'm going to let James give us 30 seconds on why you might be interested in Bavincks, and then we're going to talk about something completely different, because much as Bavincks are fascinating, that's not our conversation today.
Wow, 30 seconds. Okay,
so 30 seconds.
two awesome Christian thinkers. One was a theology professor, but who lived a fascinating life where he did a whole lot of different things and thought about them with great clarity as a Christian and wrote about them. So a real example of quite an amazing life of integration, I guess, a life of integrity in that sense, of very holistic Christian thinking and living. That was Herman, and his nephew was J.H. Bavinck, who was a bit like a Hudson Taylor figure, if you're familiar with that name. He was a Christian missionary. They were from the Netherlands, but he was a Christian missionary in Indonesia and had quite a fascinating story to tell as well. Did a lot of great work in thinking about Christianity and culture and the gospel, the Christian message as it relates to different cultures across the world.
Fascinating. Well done. That was, I think, under 30 seconds. So proud of you. A man who can write books on something and then also give us only 30 seconds touching on it is a remarkable thing. James, as a Brit in America, I frequently have people ask me if I watch what in America is called the Great British Baking Show. But I think in England it's called the Great British Bake Off. Is that right?
Yeah. In the UK, it's the Great British Bake Off. And I'm always puzzled by what culturally is weird about the idea of a bake off and why that needs to be translated as a baking show. But it's called the Great British Bake Off.
I think I may be completely wrong on this. I had heard, and do not quote me on this because my sources may be fake, that somehow like Pillsbury owns the word or the expression bake off, so it's not allowed to be called that. But maybe it's just
weird.
Maybe it's like Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which in America is called the Sorcerer's Stone, just to sort of make it easy on the ear. Anyway, who can say?
So I'd assumed before that it was like, when I was growing up, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were the big thing in the early 1990s and an American export. But in the UK, it had to be rebranded the Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles, because whoever gets to make these decisions thought that the word ninja would be too violent for British children. So I don't know. I'd wondered if there was some kind of opposite effect with the bake-off being too, culturally inappropriate for Americans, but it's weird if it's to do with copyright. There you go.
That's funny, because I remembered it, not that I have actually watched it, but as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Hero Turtles, which maybe tells you that I was born to be a Brit living in America and kind of combining two cultures.
Mid-Atlantic.
The reason I'm bringing this up, James, is because, people often tell me that I should watch this show. And I'm sure it's great, but I never have, because it doesn't interest me at all. Like the idea of watching people baking things and then talking about them, like I have no interest in it, whatever. And everybody who's listening can, throw their hands in the air now in horror at the heresy I just voiced, but I'm not interested. However, talking with a friend last Tuesday night, I heard her mentioning the Great British Baking Show to another friend. I thought, I have something to say, because you had recently told me that one of the judges on the Great British Baking Show had made some comments about the question of euthanasia that you had ended up engaging in public as well. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit about that situation and how that connection came up, and then even maybe just at a very basic level explain to us, like, what is euthanasia, what is this conversation about, and we can kind of go from there.
Sure. Okay,
so tell us this. What's the connection between the Great British Baking Show and euthanasia?
So the backdrop is that one of the judges on the show, Prue Leith, who is a baker. She's a restaurateur, a kind of national treasure in the UK. I don't know if American culture has an equivalent of national treasures, but they're people who are expected to be widely loved wherever they go. And they have a kind of feel good aura about them wherever they go. And people generally celebrate them a lot. So it's a distinct kind of British celebrity that everyone feels particularly close to. So has that kind of status. Her name is Prue Leith. And she's been campaigning around the UK pretty determinedly recently for the introduction of euthanasia, which is something that is currently illegal in the various countries of the UK, although that may change. And euthanasia is something that is not legal in most countries in the world. It's really in a small minority of countries where it is. And it's defined differently in those countries. So in the UK, it's defined as a deliberate intervention undertaken with the express intention of ending a life to relieve intractable suffering. So it's a medical intervention to take the life of somebody who is deemed to be suffering unbearably. Whereas in a country like the Netherlands, also in Western Europe, it doesn't get called euthanasia, it gets called assisted suicide. And when a life is terminated upon request of the person involved, so you can ask for your life to be ended and then receive that as something that's deemed as medical treatment. So Prue Leith's been campaigning for this to be introduced in the UK. There's a big push for it in the Scottish Parliament from one particular member of Parliament who wants to see this introduced in Scotland. So part of what I do, you introduced my job before as an academic at the University of Edinburgh, and I teach theology there. But something that I also do as part of my work is write for the general public. And I try and do so particularly from a Christian perspective to try and help people think through public issues. So I wrote a column for the Times newspaper, the Times on this side of the Atlantic rather than the New York Times, engaging with Prue Leith's arguments and trying to provide some kind of alternative perspective and the question of whether euthanasia is a good thing, whether we should want to have this in Scotland.
So tell us first, whether referencing her argument specifically or kind of more broadly, why might people be in favour of euthanasia or assisted suicide, depending on what language you want to use? What are the primary arguments that people might want to make?
Yeah. So the primary argument is a really powerful one for people in secularized, individualistic Western cultures. And Scotland is very much that, as is the US. So the primary argument is individual autonomy. So one of Prue Leith's key lines in her argument is, why should someone be forced to live a life that they don't want to live? Why should you have to carry on living your life if you don't want to live it? So the idea is that it's an extension of the kind of autonomy and individual choice that should mark out your entire life. That should also mark whether you want to live or not at the end. So the key foundation in the argument is individual autonomy, that you get to decide for yourself these fundamental things about your life, actually, including when it will end. So when that's presented to people in Scotland, for example, in the big political drive to get public support for this, the question that's put to the public is, do you think terminally ill people should have a say in how they die? And if you answer yes to that, that's deemed to be a voice in favor of euthanasia. But I think where this gets really complicated is that I agree fully that terminally ill people should have a say in what's going on around their deaths, but I don't support euthanasia. So I think that in the kind of public debate that we have at the moment, there's a very powerful foundation in the argument. It really latches on to how people imagine themselves as human beings, and what a good human life looks like is a life with a tremendous amount of self-determination, that you should live on your own terms. But also there's quite a blurry public understanding of what end of life care is actually like, and the kind of medical culture that we have. And that the distinction between, for example, euthanasia or assisted suicide and palliative care, which is trying to minimize suffering for people when they're dying and try to make those last moments of this life as free of suffering as possible medically, but without actually taking steps to kill that person. Those are very different things. But a lot of the kind of public perception in Scotland is really not very aware of palliative care, even though it's quite a major feature of our healthcare system. And the way that euthanasia is presented, I think, really confuses it with palliative care. So should a terminally ill person have a say in how they die? I think absolutely they should have a say in whether, if they're terminally ill, they can die at home, what kind of pain relief they can have, all manner of things the patient's voice is really important for. But saying that is not an affirmation of the idea that assisted suicide is the only way to express that.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. A friend of mine died last year in September, I believe it was, and she'd had a recurrence of the breast cancer that she'd had a couple of decades earlier and had come through, and she was at a point in her life, she wasn't especially old, she was actually you know, very young in Western terms to be close to death, but she, as a follower of Jesus in particular, she actually felt very ready to die, and she decided that rather than, you know, pursuing the most aggressive forms of treatment that might extend her life, you know, a year or 18 months as it were, that she opted after, you know, one round of chemotherapy, she opted actually to go the other path and to say, you know, can we stop doing these treatments and instead have a hospice care approach? So as you point out there, there's a distinction between somebody having agency and making choices about how, you know, as a terminally ill person, how and when they might die, an actual intervention that would kind of cause that death. Give us a sense, James, so I believe your wife is involved on the kind of medical side of things, if you're happy to talk about this. Give us a sense of sort of her perspective as somebody who's involved in medical care of people who might be in some of these situations and what light that sheds on the situation.
Yeah, sure. So my wife is a medical doctor, a physician. She works in what in the UK is called geriatric medicine, so medicine of the elderly. And she works in a particular branch of medicine of the elderly called hospital at home. She works with a team of doctors and nurses and other medical professionals who treat particularly elderly people in their own homes with the ideal that they don't have to be admitted to a normal hospital. For all kinds of reasons, people fare much better when they're being treated in their own homes. It's not, you know, this kind of strange environment that's very unfamiliar, especially for older people. But also a lot of her patients are dying and are facing all the kind of things that come with old age. So a lot of her work is focused on trying to help people to have a comfortable final period of life in their own homes. And she's really deeply committed to that and works with others who are as well. But she's also really strongly against euthanasia because that it's a very fundamental way of reimagining what a doctor is there to do, what kind of a presence a doctor has in a patient's life. If from the patient's perspective, the doctor could be someone who offers you death as well as prolonging the life that you have. So she's pretty firmly against this kind of change in the law in Scotland. If it were to change, it's not the kind of practice that she would ever engage in, but it would make her working environment a very different one. She has all kinds of, I guess, different reasons for being very skeptical of it as a medical practitioner, particularly with something that you see quite often with older people who perceive themselves as a burden on their extended families, and also with all kinds of complexities with the fact that these people are very often not just individuals who've got no connections to other people, and trying to work out agency, for example, you know, just how much this is truly what the individual would want for themselves if there were no financial considerations involved, or whether they're doing this just because they think, well, I have to choose. Do I choose euthanasia or do I choose to carry on, you know, costing the health service money and, you know, costing my family money for care and all that kind of stuff. Determining what the patient actually wants is, even without euthanasia, with other things in terms of intervention and care, is already quite difficult. and from her perspective, how you would move from that to not just things like antibiotics, but actually deadly drugs, for example, and administering those on the basis of agency, she thinks is quite a complex minefield. That side of things is very much her profession rather than mine, and she has her own medical views on that. But I think the kind of voice that I try and have in this debate is quite a different one, actually, because the question of euthanasia, at one level, it's not a scientific question, purely in terms of, you know, medicine or the natural sciences or something like that. Doctors already have, medical science already has, you know, combinations of chemicals that can be administered that will end a life. It's not a question of, can we do this? The question is, should we do it? And then that question needs just distinct people who are able to contribute to those discussions, who are trained in ethics and philosophy and theology, and who are able to think through the should question rather than the can question. So that's part of why I stepped into this debate. And I've written on it over a few years, actually, in newspapers over here, trying to provide a slightly different perspective, and just try to make people think through the should issue. I'm not overwhelmed by the rigor with which our politicians at the moment are trying to think this through.
Mm-hmm.
Because, there's a celebrity effect. Someone like Prulith comes and addresses the members of parliament in Scotland. And in those kinds of debates, particularly religious voices like mine are just seen as problems, as though, you know, the obvious thing to do if you're caring and compassionate is approve euthanasia and bring that in. And religious people just, you know, we just want you to suffer and make the end of your life as hard as possible. I don't think that's true at all. I think that Christianity gives you really firm reasons to want to relieve suffering, actually, but it also gives you really firm reasons to value the dignity of every human's life and not to want people to think, I have to choose death because I'm just a burden and I no longer have dignity and all that's been lost, and that was all very conditional. So I think the kind of combination that my wife and I think through is that her example, I personally find a very powerful one, of watching a Christian who works in medicine, you know, giving her utmost to try and help people die comfortably and well at home, surrounded by their loved ones. But she is totally against euthanasia. The kind of paradigm that our politicians think through a lot of the time, which is, you know, the religious people are just the baddies in this and the kind of heartless ones. It's just not true. And I think that I try and complement her work through the kind of reasoning that I'm trying to do in public, with helping people think through that maybe there's actually a really good and reasonable case to continue to oppose euthanasia rather than bring it in as though it's going to be wonderful for everyone.
Yeah, my brother is actually also a doctor working in the UK, and a lot of his medical work has been with older patients who are very seriously ill because of the nature of his work. And like your wife, one of the things that he has observed in many circumstances is people, as you say, feeling like they're a burden on their family and feeling like, well, actually, everybody would be better if I wasn't here. And how that plays into somebody's decisions about their own, the end of their life, to where it's probably a narrative we actually don't often hear in these public conversations, to where it's less, boldly taking my destiny into my own hands, and this is absolutely, you know, what I want, and more people who feel a deep sense of sort of love and obligation toward their family, and a diminishing sense of their own value, in the context of those relationships. So help us think then, James, from a Christian perspective about this issue, and what the most compelling, from your perspective, arguments are actually against allowing euthanasia to become legal and to be something that we as a society embrace.
So I think from a Christian perspective, life has a very particular importance as a gift in Christianity. And it's rooted in the fact that God, the living God, is the giver of life. And therefore, life is inherently precious. And you see that throughout the Bible, that life really matters. That the reason, the way that the Bible describes human beings as really distinctly special and valuable in universal terms is that human beings are the image of God. And that's an incredibly dignified way to describe humans. Mm. It doesn't turn them into God. We're the image of God rather than God. But humans are just wonderful, remarkable creatures, and that dignifies human life. And actually, when you look at the kind of logic that you find in the Bible for why killing another human being is wrong, it's most fundamentally rooted in that irrevocable special status, that it's wrong to kill a human because a human is made in the image of God. So life is this gift within Christianity, and then Christianity, I guess it brings with it the assumption that life is worth living. And in Christianity, that's a universal statement for humans, that because we have this dignity and this gift of life, that it is worth living. And I don't think the Bible is naive in thinking that, you know, that human life is always awesome and wonderful, and that it doesn't come without suffering. If you read a book like Job in the Old Testament, which is this, you know, 42 chapters of this guy who goes through unbelievable suffering, and in terms of his family and circumstances and health, the Bible's full of stories of the difficulties of human life. It's not a naive book at all, but throughout its constant assumption is that that there's a dignity about human life that's actually not conditional, that can't be lost through circumstantial change. And I think that's given people in, I guess, particularly throughout Western cultures, like in the UK, and I think in the United States as well, a sort of default assumption that yes, life is worth living, but there's something that's crept into Western culture that makes us now think, but maybe not all life, or maybe there's a particular kind of life that's not worth living. So when I hear people in the UK talk about this, quite often you hear things like, well, my life would cease to be worth living if I became incontinent, you know, if I just couldn't hold my stool in, or something like that, or my life would no longer be worth living if ... And then you insert the thing that while you're still healthy and well, you think would make your life unbearable. So I think that it's important to remember that while a lot of these issues are presented as debates about legislation and political debates, ultimately it comes down to real people and some of their most vulnerable moments, some of the hardest moments in life. And I think, you know, you hear a lot of people who'll say things like, if I were to lose my continence or something like that, then I would lose my dignity and life wouldn't be worth living. But I think when Christians engage with that, we bring a very different set of questions about, well, what is dignity? And is it as easily lost as that? And actually, let's say then you were to lose your continence through having Crohn's disease or colitis or something like that, not a terminal illness, but a chronic one. Does that mean that that person's life isn't worth living either? And why restrict things to terminal illness then if dignity is so conditional in that sense? So I think that bringing, we could call it, I guess, like faith-based perspectives into the debate is actually really important because of a very different set of questions that it makes us ask, but that are so significant to those moments. I mean, if you can help someone see that actually your dignity isn't tied to how well you can like defecate or not, it's actually because you're a human being. And that can't be lost, and that you have this value that nothing can take away. I think that's a really important factor to have within this. And then that makes you really, it makes you revisit and rethink the question of which life is worth living, what kind of a life is worth living, and what kind of a life would be so bad that you should actually choose to die rather than live.
Mm. We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. Ever since Jesus' female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Yeah, I mean, this is tied up with something that we've touched on in a number of previous episodes, which is the basic kind of Christian ethical assumption that actually all human beings are fundamentally kind of morally valuable because we are human beings made in the image of God. And I would go even a step further than that to say, we are the kind of people for whom the Son of God was willing to give his life. Like the value placed on humans is actually not connected to our capacities. Because as soon as it is, you know, the fact that you're smarter than I am, or the fact that so-and-so is taller than, you know, as soon as we make it a sliding scale, we've lost that basic moral understanding that flows out of the pages of the scriptures and has flowed down the centuries, at least in the West to us today, to where it seems like basic moral common sense, at least in some conversations where people would say, yes, regardless of how intelligent you are, regardless of your racial background, regardless of your physical capabilities, regardless of X, Y, and Z, or Z, as the Americans would say, you know, we're not going to say one human being is more valuable than another. That's a deeply kind of Christian truth that I think even folks today who would see themselves as very far from Christianity in the West will make moral arguments on the basis of that to say that, you know, the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed should be cared for and not trampled, for instance. Then in some of these conversations on the edges of human life, and I would say that applies, you know, at both ends of the spectrum of human life, from the unborn to those who are close to death, would say, well, actually, no, we're going to start saying an unborn baby or a person who's terminally ill and perhaps, you know, very, very old has sort of slipped out of that category of human beings who are universally morally valuable. And actually, without Christianity, it's we don't just lose those people on the edges, as it were, which all of us once were and all of us one way or another will one day become. We actually lose everyone in the middle too. Because if there is no God who made us in his image, if there is no God who loved us enough to send his son to die for us, we are just atoms and molecules. You know, whether you or I can choose when we defecate or not is sort of beside the point. We're gelatinous membranes and chemicals and, you know, all the physical things that we know that we are. And our moral value is pure imagination. You know, and actually, like,
and it's arbitrary.
Everything kind of goes, everything goes so up in smoke.
I mean, I think it's also true that it's certainly true that Christianity isn't the only religion that gives compelling reasons to be against euthanasia. There are pretty compelling opponents of euthanasia who you can find writing from Jewish and Muslim perspectives as well. But I think like belief in God provides quite compelling logic that really undermines it, just because of how much actually belief in God universalizes that norm, that human value and that sense of dignity. And to remove, you know, God from the picture entirely, and to think from an atheist perspective, like, to choose which lives are the dignified ones and which lives shouldn't have access to euthanasia, then becomes an arbitrary choice.
Yeah.
So to go back to the Prulith article in the Times that I mentioned, the thing that I was trying to pick up on was something that just doesn't work in her argument for euthanasia, which is that terminally ill people who can consent should have the freedom to choose assisted suicide. Only those people, though. So if you don't meet those criteria, then it's not on the table for you. But the reason that terminally ill people should have that is because of individual autonomy. Because whose life is it? It's your life. No one else has any say over it. And there's no God in that picture. And that doesn't work for a bunch of different reasons, I think. It's a really flawed combination of ideas. But part of the problem is that if the basis for being allowed to choose assisted suicide as a terminally ill person is individual autonomy. Well, why should individual autonomy be limited only to that freedom for terminally ill people? Let's say instead I decide I would actually like to have assisted suicide available before I become terminally ill. You know, why should I have to wait until I lose my continence in order for this medical service to be offered to me? Why can't I choose to preclude that suffering entirely? Why should I have to wait? And so the kind of position that is on offer at the moment in Scotland, prospectively, is restricted to terminally ill people who can consent. And we're told all the time by the voices who want this that it'll never be expanded, it's not a slippery slope or anything like that. But I don't think that's true if you ground it in individual autonomy. Because once you, I think if that's the motivating factor for this, then any restrictions on individual autonomy do become just really arbitrary. So, you know, why should you have to wait to get a certain diagnosis? So in the Netherlands at the moment, there's one particular political party that has been trying to get assisted suicide expanded to everyone once they reach the age of 75, that it becomes on offer for you, just as an age category. It's called, once you reach 75, you've reached what in Dutch is called a voltooid leven, a completed life. And if you want to carry on living after that, you can, but no questions asked. You know, you could also have assisted suicide.
Although one wonders why pick that number? I mean,
indeed, it's arbitrary. Yeah.
The situation right now, as I understand it, you know, in the UK and in the US, is if somebody is actively suicidal, actually, perhaps because they're feeling profound emotional and psychological distress, aside from any physical symptoms, if somebody is sort of actively suicidal, they can be, against their will, actually put into an institution where they're prevented from taking those steps, and that I think few of us would say, well, that's only an infringement on their autonomy. Probably I think most of us would say, no, that is an opportunity for them to be saved from themselves at that time, and to be cared for in a way that we hope will bring them to a point where they no longer wish to end their lives. Sort of to give them that pause. I mean, the tragic reality right now is that actually it's an awful lot of kind of adolescent and teenage girls and boys. I think, you know, especially girls, there seems to have been a massive uptick in suicidal ideation and attempts among our younger people, actually. It's sort of hard to know how one would argue ethically that you reach an arbitrary age where your life is completed and suddenly you can make those kinds of choices, whereas we wouldn't want that earlier. I wonder as well, James, so it seems to me that one of the most shocking and beautiful things that Christianity says to us is that actually, no, you're not your own. Mm. Your body does not belong to you. You were made with love by the creator of the universe as an individual called into relationship with him, and that you were worth the death of his son, Jesus. And one of the kind of shocking and beautiful things that the Apostle Paul writes in the New Testament is, you are not your own. You were bought at a price, so honor God with your body. That's sort of a message to Christians. How do you think, James, this whole conversation about euthanasia should lead us to reflect on, like, what is it about being a human that makes us valuable sort of relationally, even? And how does that help us to think through, you know, even if we are in a season of life where we might be a, you know, quite burden on others, whether because we're very young or very old or very sick or very psychologically distressed, how that doesn't take away our value, but actually affirms our value?
Yeah, what a great question. Yeah, profound one. And actually a hard one to grapple through, I think, for Christians in Western cultures, because we're so conditioned by and enculturated within individualism at such a deep level that learning to think about ourselves and or to decenter your identity a bit into something that's more than just yourself. So your relationships to others, as well as your relationship to God, is actually, it's a bit counterintuitive to us. And I think in that regard, the the church is kind of up against it in the campaign against euthanasia in general in Western cultures at the moment. It makes Christianity all the more countercultural. Yeah, I think understanding your relationship to God, the more that you think about it, the more it's actually, it redefines so much of the human experience of suffering. A couple of years ago, I was in Australia at a conference, and I was listening to a medical doctor who also works in practical theology, who'd written a book on dementia and your relationship to God. And something that he pointed out was that the way that humans think about time and the way that we inhabit time and our lives, especially in Western cultures, is very moment by moment. You know, that you are who you are at this specific moment, but that can be quite detached from who you were yesterday or 10 years ago. And that makes something like dementia, for example, extremely, I mean, dementia is so difficult for so many reasons. But one of the hard things about it is that it can make you seem to change as a person really dramatically in, you know, the final stages of this life. But the point that this guy was making in his book, I guess, and in his lecture is that, as in theology, we would put it like this, and it's maybe a slightly technical term that I can clarify, but that God is equidistant to every point in time. Hmm. And that means that God is no more distant from you 10 years ago as he is from you right now, or you 10 years before that, or you, you know, with who you might be 10 years from now. Because God is infinite and God is eternal. So God is equidistant to every point in time in your life. And actually the way that he is able to relate to you is not that God can only, that God is restricted to the moment that you're in right now. So if, you know, if you're ravaged by advanced Alzheimer's and, you know, you're like the narrative of your life takes a really hard turn at the end and you feel like you've lost yourself, or the people who look on and your family look on and you know, it's harder to relate to you and so on. God doesn't have that struggle. God isn't bound to that moment. And in fact, his commitment to you is not just moment by moment. He's equidistant to every point of time in your life. And I think hearing someone who was a very skilled practical theologian and a medical doctor put that across, I mean, I'd studied the infinity of God and the eternity of God and the doctrine of God, you know, as a systematic theologian, but I'd never really connected it to pastoral care and to thinking about suffering and what it means to have a relationship with the eternal God in your time-bound existence. For me, that was just mind-blowing and made me think about suffering in my own life in a very different kind of way, to realize that to be in a relationship with God like that is really liberating in that regard. But I think in Western cultures, we don't inhabit the time of our lives in that kind of way very intuitively. It's very much all about now. And that's also a factor, I think, for a lot of people in why a lot of people argue for assisted suicide, because there isn't really a moment outside of the one that you're in. And there's also not always there's not something beyond the final moment of this life either.
Yeah, and I wonder, even related to that, whether we have lost, and I want to be careful how I say this, because I don't think that we should be kind of reveling in suffering, our own or that of others. But I think perhaps we have lost the capacity to value suffering in as much as it actually reminds us of our helplessness and of our need for God. Which, if what the Bible says is true, then the person who is most aware of their utter dependence, moment by moment, on God, and that they have nothing to offer, as it were, is actually probably the person with the greatest spiritual insight. And even might be in a position to be used to share that with others. I think of famously Francis Collins, the former president of the National Institutes of Health over here, former head of the Human Genome Project, who, having grown up in a secular home, was first prompted to take Christianity seriously because of a far less educated patient he was treating as a junior doctor, who was crying out to Jesus in the midst of her severe and untreatable pain, and who then asked him, you know, she explained what she believed and asked him, "Doctor, what do you believe?" And it was that question from this woman in a very physically painful season of her life, where many from the outsider would have thought, well, what is she adding to the world right now? Perhaps she could have been seen as a burden on the health system or whatever, who instead was holding out the hope of Jesus to this man who had no access to it before, and who from that point on started to seriously consider whether there might be hope for him in the face of suffering and death, just as this woman had shown her hope. So I just wonder if we, again, I want to kind of be careful how I phrase it, but if our worldview is such that we can only we cannot see any possible value or meaning perhaps is the word, in suffering, then we're, I think, missing out on so much that might be rich in human experience, even if it's not comfortable.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Christianity asks us to do a couple of things at the same time. And the combination is maybe a bit counterintuitive to a lot of people around us at the moment. So it asks us both to learn to see that actually there's something redemptive and instructive about suffering, that the experience of suffering in this life doesn't have to be in vain, and that even in ways that it can be truly awful, God is nonetheless able to bring good from those experiences, not in a way that diminishes them or belittles the experience. And yet somehow Christianity is a faith that says that ultimately it's not that good and evil are balanced at 50-50 forever in this world, but that good conquers evil and light conquers darkness. But at the same time, Christianity also gives us a really profound ethical impulse to relieve suffering where we find it, because of the worth of human beings. And so, I mean, I think if you think of the ancient world, okay, and ancient Greek philosophy, which, might sound like the kind of luxury academic subject that maybe someone will study at university now, but if you go back to their world, these were just the philosophies of life that people tried to use to navigate experiences like suffering. And if you think of the New Testament world, like with the Epicureans and the Stoics as two major groups of philosophers, you know, Stoicism was all about, you know, Marcus Aurelius and recognizing that you're stronger than you think you are. And if you just tap into that deep inner core, then you can just kind of grit your teeth and have a stiff upper lip and flourish in the face of suffering, and you rise above the suffering because you are mightier than it. That's really hard for a lot of people to do, you know, existentially and experientially. But for the Epicureans, it was a very different philosophy of life. It was that you need to try and live in quite a careful balance between doing the things that maximize pleasure whilst minimizing pain. And that means recognizing that there are some things that might give you a lot of pleasure, but they'll also give you a lot of pain. So you hold back from those things, and you try and live with the largest small pleasures that you can find.
Right.
But also just try and shield yourself off from the capacity to feel pain psychologically and physically, and you're kind of averse to that. And I think when we look at the culture around us, I see a lot of people who are drawn to a kind of neo-stoicism, where they're all trying to work out that actually, yes, especially lots of young men right now are trying to make themselves believe that they're much stronger than they think they are. And that gives them a particular outlook on suffering. But I think that there are lots of people as well who are very Epicurean in style, and being very, like, they're kind of locked within this struggle to try and have as much pleasure as you can, but also have as little suffering as you can as well, and as little pain. So if we're talking about Christianity as an alternative to how you think through the purpose of life in relation to the question of suffering, or the question of pleasure as well, it's there alongside rival philosophies of life that are out there. And I personally find it quite compelling as an alternative to either of those, and want to lean into it and try and live within it. I think it gives you the most livable philosophy of life when we think about issues of suffering. So it doesn't belittle the experience of suffering at all. And I personally find it really frustrating, even as a Christian. So I've dealt with really serious illness in my life as well for a number of years, and I've had to have some pretty huge surgeries and so on. I find it really frustrating if other Christians belittle what that was actually like to go through, just by saying, God made all things good, and isn't it great that you're over that now? It was really hard. It was an awful experience. So I don't appreciate the kind of belittling of it, but at the same time, in the Christian faith, good conquers evil and good wins out in the end because God is good. Yeah. And, you know, there's also something that's really wrong with, let's say, in my experience of, you know, if there was no hope at all in that suffering, well, that's really not a Christian way to think. So there are all kinds of redemptive things and ways that I can see, especially retrospectively, that actually God did all kinds of things in my life through the experience of really awful physical suffering.
Yeah.
So it doesn't ask me to belittle it, and it tells me that it can be redemptive. But that also doesn't just mean that I don't care about the sufferings of others. It actually gives me all kinds of reasons to want other people to be free from suffering. And I think that when you start thinking like that, and then you enter the euthanasia debate, particularly as I see it in my own context in Scotland, where the way that it's framed by the pro-euthanasia advocates is religious people don't care about people and their suffering. They don't care enough, and they want people to die horrible deaths and all that kind of stuff. So therefore, vote for euthanasia. It's just not true.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and actually, at the very heart of the Christian faith, we see the strongest man who ever lived dying the most horrific death ever died. And that on the cross, not only is Jesus taking the sin of the world, so the sin of any who will put their trust in him and making sort of payment for it, bringing forgiveness, but he's also taking upon himself the suffering that we endure, that he's identifying with us in our pain, so that whatever you, if you're listening to this, whatever you are going through today, whether it is physical suffering, whether it is psychological pain, whether it is a sense of meaninglessness in your life, whether you are inches yourself from wanting to end your life, at the heart of the Christian message is the one who knows you better than you know yourself, who loves you more than you could possibly imagine, and who gave his own life in exchange for yours, so he can be with you in what you're struggling with right now, and he can offer you hope and life and light and love through that and on the other side of that. So my hope is that whatever stage of life you find yourself in, that you would, like James and me, pin your hope on that Jesus who doesn't gloss over our pain, but instead steps into it. Thank you so much, James, for your time and for sharing some of your thoughts and reflections on this. And I look forward to seeing you in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. Great to talk.